Gittin, Perek Hey, Mishnah Vav, 5-6. The primary topic of this Mishnah is the halachas as they deal with these people and this phenomenon called Sikrikon, which are kind of like these non-Jewish mafioso extortionists. And it has a side point as well. That's a different topic. Now, it's been put here presumably because of a takana that the rabbis made regarding the Sikrikon. And while that takana is not a takana for the sake of tikkun olam, it is a takana that has to do with stolen land. And since the previous mission had talked about a takana that had to do with stolen property, so presumably that got placed here as well. So now this Mishnah is a little bit tricky to follow. So let me try to explain the structure of the Mishnah first, and then we'll go back and we'll see it inside. So the structure of the Mishnah is as follows. The primary topic, like I said, is this Sikrikon. The word Sikrikon, what it actually means literally, its etymology is sort of not perfectly clear at all. Chazal do bring in Notrikon, as they do for essentially all imported or borrowed words from foreign languages. Essentially, the bartender brings it in Bikurim, that Sikrikon is a portmanteau, a Notrikon, for the words Sa Karkai Vahanicheni, which means take my property and leave me alone, literally. And the idea is that the Sikrikon with these kind of, you know, mafia Gentile extortionists who essentially put a gun to the owner of some land's head and said, give me your land or else I've got an offer you can't refuse. And so then the Jew essentially hands over their property. So the basic principle of Sikrikon is that it doesn't count as a sale. And if somebody, we'll call him Shimon, buys this property from the Sikrikon, but Sikrikon had essentially extorted it, they'd essentially stolen it, for lack of a better term, from Reuven. So then even though Shimon bought the field, it still belongs to Reuven, and Reuven and Shimon need to work it out. Okay? So now the details of how that's quote-unquote worked out is the topic of our Mishnah. And the Mishnah actually has four distinct historical periods, and the halachas that apply to the Sikrikon are changing over time. I know there's rabbinic enactments to how to deal with this phenomenon, changes based on the facts on the ground and based on the rabbi's interest in establishing in encouraging lands and back up in Jewish control. So, stage one of this of the four historical stages in the Mishnah is during the first Great War of the Jews against the Romans, around the time of Chorban Bais Rishon, Bais Sheni, excuse me, so around the cult years, 68 to 73, something like that, of the Common Era. And that's stage one. And at that time, there was a sort of a mitzvah by the Gentiles enforced by the Romans to kill the Jews, and therefore the Jews essentially had nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. And therefore the assumption is that if a Jew gives over his property to a Gentile, essentially to save his life, he doesn't think he's going to be able to take him to court later on and get his land back. He doesn't think that. He just says, you know, think it was like, you know, 1939 Poland. Just, if you let me live, I'll give you whatever you want, and I'll be happy to live, and that's all I'm going to ask for. Then you have stage two is after that, after the Great War, the first Great War of the Jews, in which the mitzvah to kill Jews had, you know, gone off the books and subsided, and therefore, if these mafiosos come and put a gun to a Jew's head and he agrees to give his property away, so what he's thinking is, I'm going to save my skin now and I'll deal with this later on through the legal system to get my land back. Okay, so that is your classic Sikrikon case. And the basic point of our Mishnah, I'm keeping this very simple for a moment, we'll see details shortly, is although Reuven gave his field to the Sikrikon, he intends to get it back and work it out, and he doesn't really intend to, you know, waive any rights and claim on his land. Then there's the Mishnah, then, after giving the halachas that second time period, basically sees a structural parallel to how things might work if a third party is buying land from a husband with regards to his wife's claims, her encumbrances on his property because of her ksuba. So you have like a side point. I'm not discussing that now. We'll go back to that at the end of the Mishnah, so I'll skip those words. Then you have this third historical period where people, the rabbis, observed that because of this law of Sikrikon and the basic din that if Shimon buys the land from the Sikrikon, he'll have to still deal with the original owner, Reuven. So there were just no Shimons around. Nobody was prepared to buy land if they're going to have to basically, you know, give it back to the original owner. And that being the case, the rabbi said, listen, we want Jews to step up to the plate and buy the land back, because we want the land and back up in Jewish hands. We want Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. We don't want the Gentiles essentially to sell to the Gentiles and lose political control in Israel. And therefore, you know, sort of, I'll call it, you know, de facto control over what's going on the ground over Israel. So therefore, they made a takana. They said, listen, here's a way we can work it out that Shimon can keep the land that he buys from Skirkon. He just has to give a piece of it to Reuven, keeping it simple. But even in that third stage, we kind of gave Reuven this right of first refusal. If he could afford to buy the land back, so then he could say to Shimon, listen, Shimon, that's my land, and I want it back. And the reason I didn't step up and buy myself is I was just afraid to get involved in the first place and have this, the buy back and then have it stolen another time from me, whatever it is. And because that right of first refusal still exists and the possibility of Reuven still going to Shimon and getting back his land under certain circumstances, so therefore Shimon still didn't want to buy, there were no Shimons to buy the land, and therefore in the fourth and final historical phase, which is time of Reb Yehuda Nasi, called the year 200 of the Common Era, roughly, they enacted that right of first refusal only exists for 12 months, and after that Shimon can buy the land and keep it as long as he gives a piece back to Reuven. That's the gist of the mission, okay? And the structure of it. So let me go through those now in detail, and then we'll go back and deal with the skipped part altogether about people buying property and negotiating with a wife to waive her rights for her ksuba. Okay, that's a separate point. So here the Mishnah starts out and says as follows. Lohaya sekrikon b'Yehuda b'haruge ha-milchama. In Judea, during the time of the Great War, this is Titus's war, you know, the year called the year 68, for the next several years, there was no such rule on the rule books called Sekrikon, meaning the rule that if Reuven hands over his property to Sekrikon and then Shimon buys the land from the Sekrikon, Shimon still has to give it back to Reuven. That's the basic rule of Sekrikon that didn't apply in the historical period of the Great War. And the reason is because if Reuven hands over his land to Sekrikon during that time, it was just because he was trying to save his skin and he had no thought he would ever get it back again, so he really gave it and he said, just keep the land and let me, you know, get away, and that's good enough for me. But, says the Mishnah, in stage two of the historical process, Meheruge Milchama Ve'elach, after the war was over, and this rule on the rule books, and the Gemara speaks out, there were certain phases where there was essentially you had a requirement to kill Jews under penalty if you didn't, and later on, essentially, there was a reward if you did. Whatever the point is, that all fell away, and there was no more inducement of the general populace to kill every Jew. So now, in stage two, if Reuven hands over his property to the mafioso Sekrikon guy, so he intends to later on deal with it in the courts and try to get it back. And that being the case, Yeshba Sekrikon, there is such a rule in the books called Sekrikon, which means that Reuven still isn't really giving it away, even though he gave it to the Sekrikon, and he can get it back again. Ketzad, so how does that work? So we're going to have two possibilities here. The Mishnah won't speak it out at first, but it'll actually ultimately be, it depends on, okay, so let's see inside. So, like this. Lakach m'sekrikon, if Shimon strikes a deal with the Sekrikon, and then v'chazer v'lakach m'bal habayis, and then he says, listen, I'm not going to formally hand over the money to Sekrikon and buy this land unless I get a waiver from Reuven that he's not going to steal it, make me give it back to him, as the rules of Sekrikon applies. So if that's what happens, Reuven first goes to Sekrikon, strikes a deal, and then he gets a waiver from, Shimon strikes a deal with the Sekrikon and then gets a waiver from Reuven. Mikcho batel, that waiver doesn't count for anything, it's annulled in the courts, meaning that even if Reuven gave over such a waiver to Shimon, once Shimon gets his hands on the property, Reuven can go to Shimon and say, listen, that's my property and I want it back. Reuven will have to give him the money that he laid out, so he'll not be out of pocket, but he'll spend a lot of time and effort for nothing. Okay, now the Gemara speaks out, well, maybe Reuven really meant to, in truth, cut a deal with Shimon and give a waiver in exchange for something. Maybe he got paid some money or something. So the Gemara says, listen, if Reuven went so far as to essentially indemnify Shimon and say, listen, Shimon, if once you have my field in your hands and I'm waiving subsequent rights to take it back from you, and if some other creditor comes and says they have a shibud, they have an encumbrance on this land, and therefore they want, you know, to collect from the land you're buying, I'm indemnifying you, I'll make you whole, I'll take care of you elsewhere, so you're protected. So that already would indicate that Reuven is motivated for his own economic interest and not just to not fight with the Sakrikon. And that being the case, the deal would actually be binding and the waiver would be binding. But otherwise, we're going to say, listen, the only reason that Reuven agreed to give a waiver to Shimon, even if he was offered money, whatever it is because he was afraid that if Reuven wouldn't give a waiver, Shimon would go back to Sakrikon and say, listen, I would buy your field, it's just that, you know, the previous owner Reuven won't give me a waiver, and under Jewish law, he can come take it from me, so I'm walking away from the deal. If that would happen, then of course Mr. Sakrikon, who's obviously he's already an unfriendly, dangerous character, would then go back to Reuven and punish him for undermining his sale. So therefore, we would say the only reason Reuven agreed to waive his rights that are afforded to him under this rule called Sakrikon rights, I'll call them, is just to protect himself, and therefore he didn't really mean it. Okay, fine. On the other hand, Mibal Habayis b'chazer v'lakach masakrikon, if first Shimon approaches Reuven and says, Reuven, I know you used to have a field, and I know now the Sakrikon got it from you, but listen, I'm prepared to go negotiate with the Sakrikon. Just first, you know, I'll give you $100 and you waive your rights to take it from me under the rules of Sakrikon. And Reuven says, okay, I'll accept that. $100 is better than a poke in the eye. It's better than nothing. I'll take that. So now, if Shimon then goes to the Sakrikon and negotiates a purchase, that purchase is binding. The reason why is because when Reuven agreed to that waiver for the $100, so the Sakrikon didn't know about this yet. So it's not that Reuven was motivated because he was afraid of Sakrikon. He didn't want to, like, you know, get in the way of his sale because he was first. And therefore, we say that Reuven was striking some deal to his economic benefit. He meant to waive his rights, and therefore it's binding, and therefore the sale is binding, and Reuven can't go back to Shimon afterwards and get the property. So therefore, Mikacho Kayam, the sale from the Sakrikon to Shimon, as well as the waiver from Reuven to Shimon, both stand and, you know, can't be contested in the courts. Now, the next lines of the Mishnah is the different topic about the husband and wife. So skip that next sentence to the words Zu Mishnah Rishona. So Zu Mishnah Rishona means this was how the Mishnah was taught originally. This was the original way the halacha applied under Sakrikon. But then, based in Shalacherim Amru, a subsequent court, like call it, I don't know, the year 100 or something like that, of the common era, that kind of whatever it is, roughly speaking, they said Amru, Halokeach Mesakrikon Nosan Labalim Revia. They said, if Shimon buys Sakrikon property, they've been confiscated from, extorted, stolen from Reuven, so then Shimon can keep it. It's just that Shimon has to give a quarter of the land, or the dollar equivalent, the economic equivalent, to Reuven. And that was kind of like a compromise, because the idea is they were observing that no one was coming to buy the land from the Sakrikonim, because they realized that the would-be Shimon's said, why should I go buy this land only to have Reuven take it back from me? So therefore, no one was buying the land, and therefore the Sakrikon would have only a non-Jew to sell his land to, and therefore the land would sort of pass into non-Jewish control, and that the rabbis didn't like. And therefore they said, listen, any Shimon who wants to buy the land, he can buy the land, and they should give a piece back to the original Reuven, original owner, and therefore Reuven gets something, and the land goes back to Jewish control. Now this number, Revia, quarter of the land, or the value, they arrived at that number because based on their observations, estimated that the Sakrikonim were selling the land at, like, basically, you know, this a discounted price because they got the land for free. They just want to sell it and turn it and make a profit, and therefore they were happy to take below market value. So the thought was that essentially whatever below market value benefit this Revia that the Shimon was getting, he would basically give that back to Reuven. Therefore, Shimon ends up getting sort of, let's speak, a fair price. He paid three-quarters of the price, gets three-quarters of the land. And Shimon did, and Reuven gets gets something, the quarterback. Now, Amasai, says the Mishnah, in this third historical period, when we said that Shimon can keep what he buys, and we're putting the Sakrikon rules aside, that's only Bezman She'ein B'yadan Likach. That's only when the original owner Reuven doesn't have the financial wherewithal to buy it himself. But if at the time of the sale to Shimon, Reuven did have you know, the money to buy the, you know, the sale price. Just perhaps, you know, Reuven just was, you know, was not, either he had a right of first refusal and we're saying he could buy it, but he wasn't offered that. Or even if he was offered it, Reuven might say, listen, I've already been through down this road. The last time I owned this property, the Sakrikan guy stole it from me, so why should I let him steal it from me again? And so he didn't buy it now. So then, Reuven, even if he didn't buy it then and there, instead of Shimon, he can go to Shimon afterwards and say, Shimon, that's my land. You laid out, you know, you paid $1,000 for it. Here's $1,000. Give me my land back. And that right would persist sort of in perpetuity. Even 5 years later, Reuven could say, listen, I was afraid to get involved when Mr. Sakrikan was around, but now I want my land back. Here's your $1,000 you laid out. Aval yesh b'yadin likach, says the Mishnah, if Reuven had the wherewithal to purchase that land, he just didn't. Hen kodem l'chol adam. Then Reuven has this right of first refusal. He can buy it before anyone else. And even if someone else, like Shimon, does go buy it from the Sakrikan, Reuven can get it back from even years later. Now, that's the third historical stage. Now, what happens is in the fourth historical phase, the rabbis observe that since this right of first refusal thing is lingering, Shimon still is afraid to buy it. All the Shimons of the world are afraid to buy the land from Sakrikan because, you know, years later after they've, you know, been investing this land, the original owner can come back and get it back for themselves, claim, you know, that they had the money all along. And therefore, in this fourth stage, they wanted to limit their right of first refusal. So Rebbe Hoshiv Bezdin, Rebbe Yehuda Nasi, established his own Bezdin in his time, and they said, listen, Nimnu, they like took a vote, and they decided as follows. Sh'im shahasa b'fnei sakrikon shnei masar chodesh. If the, I'll call them stolen lands, had been in the hands of the sakrikon for 12 months, so then kol hakodem likach zocha. Whoever buys the land from the sakrikon, he can keep it. Meaning, the right of first refusal that we had given previously to the original owner Reuven, and plus the rights from to re-buy it back for that purchase price later on, if he had the money all along, we're saying no, that's limited to 12 months. If after 12 months Reuven hasn't come and got his feel back from Sakrikan, then we're saying, listen, he waived his right of first refusal, he's waiving his rights to ever get it back, and therefore any Shimon can come and buy it, and that way we're going to encourage the Shimons of the Jewish Shimons of the world to come and buy this land to get it back into Jewish control. Aval, says the Mishnah, however, nosen labalim revia. Shimon, when he buys this land after 12 months, beginning the control of the Sakrikan, even though there's no right of Reuven to get it back from Shimon, Shimon has to give him a quarter of the land or the economic equivalent in cash, because again, the thought is he's anyways getting a bargain price, and that's to somehow give some kind of justice or compensation, or, you know, reparation to Reuven who's lost his land. That's the basic. That's the Mishnah as it flows through for Hilchos Sakrikon. Okay. Now, the part I skipped. Back after the second historical phase, we said that if Shimon first negotiates with Sakrikon and then with the original owner Reuven, we think Reuven just agreed because he was afraid of the consequence of not agreeing. He didn't want to have a fight with the Sakrikon. Whereas if Shimon first struck a deal with Reuven and then went to the current controlling person, the Sakrikon, that would be binding because of the time that Reuven agreed to waive his rights in exchange for, you know, some money or something. So then he wasn't afraid of the Sakrikon because the Sakrikon wasn't yet, you know, going to lose a deal. And therefore, he meant it and it's binding. So our Mishnah says something similar occurs with respect to land that's owned by a husband, which is serving as collateral for his wife's ksuba. So the gist of our Mishnah and the part that I skipped is as follows. The gist is that if Reuven has a wife and Reuven has a property and Shimon wants to buy Reuven's property, but he's afraid, listen, he says, listen, Reuven hasn't got much other property or no other property and he has a wife and, you know, one day Reuven's going to die and then his wife's going to come and in the time of the Mishnah, the only place that a ksuba has recourse to is to property. So Shimon thinks, listen, the wife's going to come to me in a few years and make me pay her 200 zuz. I don't want that. I want her to waive that claim from her lien on this property now. So therefore, the Mishnah says, listen, if Shimon strikes a deal with Reuven to buy the property, and then prior to, you know, consummating the deal, he goes to Reuven's wife and says, listen, please waive your rights for your ksuba from this property. So even if she waives her rights, the halacha is it doesn't count. Like this, like Reuven waving his rights, it doesn't count. Reuven raving rights with the Sakrikon doesn't count. And the reason why is because we assume, listen, what's this wife's option? She doesn't make a fight with her husband. Then he'll end up throwing her out or something. So since she wants to avoid fighting her husband, she agrees to waive her rights on the claim of the ksuba, of her ksuba, like lien on this property. But she doesn't really want to. She's doing it because she has no other option, really. So therefore, it doesn't count. It's unenforceable. And later on, the woman could go to Bezdin and claim from Shimon her ksuba because she had a first lien. And the fact that she gave a waiver was because she just didn't want to fight with her husband. Whereas, if Shimon first approaches the wife and says, listen, I know you have a lien on this property because you got a ksuba that's for 200 zuz. You know, who says you'll ever collect on it? And who says you'll ever, you know, maybe he won't divorce you. Maybe, you know, you'll die first. And it's a long way away anyways. I'll give you 10 cents on the dollar now. I'll give you, here's, you know, 20 zuz and waive your rights to that property. And if you agree, then I'll go to your husband to negotiate to buy it. So the point is, if she agrees to that, so she's agreed before her husband got involved in negotiations, it's not, and she accepts that deal, it's not because she is afraid of what her husband will say. She's acting out of her own interest, and that being the case, we assume she meant it, and therefore, if Shimon gets that waiver to her lien on the property prior to engaging with her husband, we'll say she meant it, and therefore that waiver would be binding. Okay, so that's what the Mishnah has to say inside. Let me just... okay, one more thing before I speak that. So there's two kinds of property. There's generic property the husband owns, and that's kind of how I described it. If we're talking about just generic property the husband owns, all of which is meshubad, is sort of lien to the wife, her ksuba. So the wife would never have the possibility of stopping the sale. The sale would always be binding. It's just that her lien would persist after the sale. So Shimon would own the property, but she would have a lien on the property to cover her ksuba payment. There is, however, possibilities where the property was specifically designated to cover her ksuba. Either before they got married, the husband said, listen, I have this particular property, and you can rest assured that if in the event of a death or divorce, you'd be able to collect ksuba from here, so you point to this particular place. Or let's say she brought in like what's called nechsitzon barzel. Let's say he had no property, but she brought in a parcel. And so she said, listen, I'm bringing a farm into the marriage. And she knows this is the farm from which I can collect now in the event that I need to collect my ksuba. And they, you know, there's a dollar amount set in the marriage. The ksuba, it says she brought in the farm. The farm's worth, you know what it is, 1,000 zuz. And she's guaranteed 1,000 zuz there. So that's a kind of speak, so to speak, like she has a particular claim on that particular property, which is more than a generic claim on his assets. It's a specific property that has a specific shibatar. So there, actually, since that's like she has a claim on that property specifically, so therefore she actually could object the sale itself and undermine the actual sale. And she, if she doesn't give a waiver, so then she could stop the actual transaction from happening. So the Mishnah here says inside, lakach mina ish v'chazer v'lakach mina isha. If Shimon first does a deal with Reuven and then afterwards strikes some deal with Reuven's wife, that deal strikes to the wife, there's different sheets. Either it means like a kinyan sudar, it's sort of like a symbolic, he just gets a waiver in exchange for, you know, nothing, or some nominal amount. The point is, she wasn't really getting anything out of the deal, she just was agreeing to it because she didn't want to fight with her husband. Therefore, mikcho batel, the sale is annulled. Now, which that means that if it was some generic property, the sale still stands, just the waiver is batel. But if it was actually a specific property that was there, specifically, like I'll call it her property or designated to be her protection, therefore actually she could undermine the sale itself. In contrast, mina isha, if first Shimon approaches Reuven's wife and secures this waiver, or, you know, does a deal with her and gives her the money, some money to that she'll agree to waive her subsequent rights from this particular property, and then v'chazer v'lakach mina ish, then he goes and negotiates a deal with her husband. So then even if it was a property that was specifically like given to her or brought in by her or guaranteed, you know, to be the place where she get her ksuba, even so, since she agreed to do a deal with this Shimon prior to Shimon approaching her husband, so therefore we say she did a deal because she wanted to do a deal, not because she was afraid of her husband, because the husband wasn't in the picture when she struck the deal. And therefore, mikro kayam, that transaction, the waiver, the sale, all do stand, and Shimon can keep the property because the wife agreed to it prior to him engaging with her husband, Reuven.